The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Sunday night, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences will give out the coveted Oscar to a select few contenders at a star-studded evening hosted by Jimmy Kimmel. Some aspects of the event are pretty easy to predict. There will be a few fashion don'ts, speeches will run long, and at least one joke will undoubtedly fall flat. Predicting who will actually win is a bit more complicated. Walt Hickey is 538's chief culture writer, here to share the website's mathematical picks for the winners in the big categories. And Walt, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So why is it so difficult to predict Oscar winners?
Yeah, so we're an election site typically, right? And we have a lot of different ways that we can talk about elections. We can run polls on elections. We can look at a bunch of polls on elections. But with the Oscars, it's a vote, yes, but we don't know that much about the vote in general. The idea is there's about 6,600 people who are in the Academy. We don't know their identities. We have a good idea of who some of them are, but we don't know all of them. And we can't run a poll on 6,600 people.
Right.
So what we end up doing is we end up looking at other award shows. We look at what the Screen Actors Guild votes on for actors. We look at what the Directors Guild votes on for directors. And then we look historically. And we see that most of the time, in the past 25 years, the guy who won Best Director at the Directors Guild Award goes on to win Best Director at the Academy Awards. And so we can pull a whole bunch of different critic awards and guild awards and stuff like the Golden Globes, look at how historically predictive they are, and then figure out, kind of build out a score for how much credibility we should assign those wins. And so we did this all throughout the cycle. Again, Producers Guild Award, Directors Guild Award, awards that you don't even know about. The American Cinema Editors has a fantastic track record. And we just kind of amalgamated these together into a score that kind of gives us a sense of who's winning this race.
Okay, is that as deep as the math goes?
It's a little bit deeper, but I don't want to bore your listeners.
So this Oscar tracker, you are adding attributes each time a candidate or a nominee, rather, wins an award. Are some weighted more heavily than others?
Absolutely, yeah. So to give you an example, let's talk about Best Actor real quick, right? So in Best Actor, the guy who won Best Actor at the Screen Actors Guild went on to win Best Actor at the Academy Awards 18 out of 22 times in the past 22 occasions, right?
Wow.
So that's a really good rate, right? That's 82% of the time. That's one of the best prediction records in our whole set. And more importantly, it's voted on by insiders. People who are in the Screen Actors Guild are also in the Academy. It's not like they're critics who aren't in the Academy. So we can assign a ton of credibility to this. So that has the highest score of any of the acting prizes by far.
Okay, so who's then in the lead?
In that race, it's a very cool race because Casey Affleck has been in the lead for a lot of this process, and for a while he was kind of having a distinct lead, and then he lost at the Screen Actors Guild. Denzel Washington won that super predictive award, and then Casey Affleck came back and he won at the BAFTAs, which is our second most predictive award, and he won at the Critics' Choice, which is our most predictive critic prize. So it's kind of that's the fun race to watch this year, because Casey Affleck has the lead, but he lost the single most predictive award. So when we talk about the ones that we're not sure about that are going to be really fun to watch this year, Best Actor could be a lot of fun. It could be a really interesting race.
Okay, how about Best Actress?
Best Actress is one of my favorites. So Best Actress this year, kind of, it looked like it was going to be a duel going into it between Natalie Portman, who is in this movie Jackie, and Emma Stone, who's in this movie La La Land.
Mm-hmm.
La La Land is the one that you've heard all about this year.
Right.
Then at the Golden Globes, which is oddly very predictive for Best Actress as opposed to a lot of the other awards where it's not, Isabelle Huppert, a great French actress who's in this film Elle, ended up winning that. And that got her in the conversation. And now if you look at how this race looks, Emma Stone won at the Screen Actors Guild and at BAFTA. So she's pretty much the odds-on favorite for Best Actress. But also you've got Isabelle Huppert and Natalie Portman right up behind her, basically tied. So either way, it's going to be a very cool year for Best Actress.
I'm surprised that the Golden Globes are so predictive, because that's like a really small batch of people and kind of like, you know, people who love foreign films, for example, like Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah. The Golden Globes is kind of hilarious. Last I read, there's 87 people in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, so this is not exactly again, Aaron Taylor Johnson, a performer who is not highly regarded this year in the Oscar race, ended up winning at the Golden Globes Best Supporting Actor. They're a really fluky group, you know, and they are kind of useless on most of these awards, but it's just like two of, like, it's Best Supporting Actor that historically they've been solid at, and oddly enough, Best Actress. They're pretty good at that one.
All right, well, let's dive into a couple of the other big categories. How about Best Picture?
Best Picture, you know, this looks like it might be a three-way race going into this year between Moonlight and Arrival, or rather Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea and La La Land, but La La Land just ran away with this one, you know.
In which one? Didn't it just win the Directors Guild this weekend? I can't recall.
This past weekend, it did not win. There was the Writers Guild, and Moonlight ended up winning at the Writers Guild in the category with La La Land. But that's not a super predictive award, right? You know how our whole thing is, we look at how historically predictive they
are?
Right. Writers Guild is not the most predictive one in this set. What is predictive, though, are some of the ones that La La Land did win, like the Directors Guild and the BAFTA Award and the Producers Guild. And it's just, you have this kind of history of doing very, very well at these predictive awards. When it comes to the films that did well at the other predictive awards, like the Screen Actors Guild, if Moonlight or Manchester by the Sea had done it well at the Screen Actors Guild, we'd be talking about them in this conversation. But actually, that went to Hidden Figures.
Well, I loved La La Land. I thought it was a terrific movie. But I really have to admit, my favorite is Moonlight. I feel like it's just so much more relevant for the world right now. And I thought it was beautifully made. And I'm wondering about you. Is there any emotion in these picks? I mean, is this hard for you? Are there movies you wish would win, but the numbers just don't work?
Yeah, totally. Again, like, La La Land was fun, but I mean, like, I'm a New Yorker, so I instantaneously don't care for those movies about Los Angeles, right? Moonlight was an extremely special film for me. I'm really glad that Arrival got a little bit of love, but I'm disappointed that Amy Adams didn't get hers this year. There's a lot of films that I like this year that are not going to get that are not going to win any awards. I actually liked Florence Foster Jenkins quite a bit, believe it or not. But my favorite one by far is Kubo and the Two Strings, which I think is my favorite movie of the whole year, and it's probably going to lose an Oscar in Best Animated Feature to Zootopia.
Okay, well, I have to ask about that because this is the first year that 538 is tracking contenders for Best Animated Feature. So how's the race looking? You said Zootopia's got it?
Yeah, again, this is a fun one. It's our first time doing it, right? But it's also one of the most exciting ones to do because everybody's seen these movies, right? If you talk about, like, again, how many folks who are listening have seen Hell or High Water? Probably not that many. How many have seen Moana? Probably a large chunk, you know? So it's one of the more conversational bits. We only had 15 years of data because the funny thing is they didn't have an animated award at an Oscar until 15 years ago. So we didn't have enough data to really predict it when we started doing this. Now that we've got 15 years, we're like, okay, we can probably make this work. So we looked at the BAFTAs, we looked at the Annie Awards, we looked at the Producers Guild, the American Cinema Editors are oddly super predictive at this. It's a cool race, you know, but I think Zootopia might have this one in the bag.
Sorry about that, Walt. But, you know, you're doing this now. Any other categories that you wish you could do? You just pretty much do the top ones.
Yeah, I'd love if we had a look into writing, but I don't know if folks are interested in hearing about that. Like, the screenplays, I think, are such a fun one because you have the movies that are almost too weird to get Best Picture in there. I think my favorite this year is The Lobster. It's this weird little movie.
Oh, I loved that movie.
Right? If like folks are listening and they want the weirdest date night ever, VOD at The Lobster. But it's a Colin Farrell movie. He's one of it's just a real good movie. And the script is the weirdest dang thing in the world. And it didn't get a lot of love. And I think it's competing in, I think, Best Original Screenplay. And you see a lot of fun ones in that category. So maybe next year, you know?
How long has 538 been tracking the Oscars? And what's your track record?
Yeah, so we've been tracking this probably about 6 years now. It's going back to even before we were with ESPN. I think it started as like there wasn't an election in a given year, and Nate wanted to try something out, so he built this model doing it. And we've done pretty decently in the past. I know about when we did this 2 years ago, I think we just missed one, Best Supporting. That was a tough year for that. And then I think when we did it last year, we missed out on Best Picture, but the reason we missed out on Best Picture was because everybody decided to award a different film last year. But it's a fun way of tracking it. Again, to call these predictions is kind of tough because, like I said, I wish that we could pull these folks, but we can't. So you're not going to get a margin of error with this kind of thing. But, you know, when we look at sites that assign odds to this kind of stuff, if you look at the people who are actually gambling money on this kind of stuff, we appear to kind of have an edge on what it looks like on this race. So It's going to be a fun year, though. I mean, if we could break the Oscars would be boring, and that wouldn't be fun at all.
Well, and I suppose people won't get as mad at you as they might over a political election.
Yeah, no. I think that the volume of mail is considerably less. And also, just from people who also don't care for Los Angeles.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a ton for having me on. I appreciate it.
Walt Hickey, he's 538's chief cultural writer, and you can check out the 538 Oscar tracker for yourself. Now, mind you, it is a real-time tracker, so things will be changing even as the awards ceremony are going on. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
I'm in heaven.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The musical La La Land is leading in sheer number of Oscar nominations this year. Historian Richard Barrios notes that musicals have been declared dead over and over again throughout history, and still they manage to rise up singing. Why is that? Why, in the depths of the Depression, did 42nd Street triumph? Why was Oliver a hit while Americans rioted in the streets and Les Miserables became an international phenomenon in the age of Hollywood pyrotechnics and reality TV? We spoke to Richard Barrios when his book Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter, first came out in 2014 to find out more about the razzly-dazzly hits, the dismal flops, and the sharp criticism. Richard Barrios, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what do you say when people say, ugh, it's a musical, I hate musicals?
Oh, I tell them they're not alone, that this sort of thing happens a lot. Musicals divide people as much as politics do, really.
You spend a lot of time in the book on what makes them work and what does not. So let's just focus on a few. Why don't we look at Singin' in the Rain, and we've got a little music to set the tone.
I'm singing in the rain. Singing in the rain.
Okay, Richard Barrios, what made that musical work?
More than anything else, I think, and there's many great things to choose from in it, but it's a musical where the script matters as much as the songs and the dances. It's an incredibly witty script, and it is a way of sort of paying tribute to all of the movie musicals that came before it. Because it starts at the very beginning of the sound era. So it encompasses all of movie musicals, and it does so very wittily and kind of nasty, too, occasionally, which I enjoy.
So how about the ones that didn't work? You can take your pick.
I can go to Paint Your Wagon. That's always a good target to hang to hang bullseyes on. They got a lot of people who could not sing, like Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood. They spent way too much money by going to a remote part of Oregon that was prone to flooding. So they chose the location very poorly. And they tried to make it really hip and current. And it was neither of those things. So it was a total misfire of the wrong material, the wrong people, the wrong intentions, the wrong amount of money spent. So it was kind of a perfect storm.
Well, there is a special and precise bond that you write about between musicals and their audience, a mutually admiring kinship, you say, unintelligible to outsiders and quite fragile. When either side violates it, crises occur. What are some of the elements that go into that plot? It isn't always that someone has a great singing voice. It's not always a plausible plot. Some great singers and duds. Give us some of these elements.
It's sort of an intangible. It has to do with understanding how music and words can connect and then how they can be transmitted to an audience for the maximum amount of comprehension and empathy. You get something like Judy Garland, a great singer, singing Over the Rainbow. And it's a situation that people can understand, a girl from Kansas longing for a world of color and magic.
There's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
That's an example of where it all comes together because it's all been thought out. And the audience is always part of the equation. And sometimes movies leave out the audience and how they might respond. And that's when a movie musical does not matter, when it forgets about its audience.
Well, you just led me to something that also makes this book so interesting, inside view of how films are produced. Over the Rainbow almost didn't make it into The Wizard of Oz.
At one point, a number of MGM producers wanted to cut it. They said, why should Judy go around singing in the barnyard? Imagine what that would have been like.
But back to this point that it has to matter in order to be successful. Don't all films have to matter to be successful?
Well, with escapism, mattering is sort of a relative concept. It doesn't have to be totally connected with current events, for example, but it has to offer something beneath the surface, I think, some sort of resonance, strike some sort of responsive chord. And that was one of the reasons that so many big musicals like Paint Your Wagon and Hello, Dolly, coming in at the end of the 1960s, seemed so clueless, because there was so much difficult going on in the world. You had Vietnam, you had riots in the United States, and here come these movies with sort of mindless optimism that seemed really willfully offensive, even, because it seemed to totally disregard what was going on. And a musical can maybe make people happy in a difficult situation or unhappy situation, but it can't be oblivious.
Well, even if My Fair Lady, Hello, Dolly, Camelot in the 1960s were tone deaf, there are movies like 42nd Street, which is a great hit during the Depression. Doesn't a musical have to be out of date somewhat to transport us?
Well, 42nd Street was as timely as a film could be, because it came in right as President Roosevelt was being inaugurated, and Warner Brothers promoted it with Roosevelt's own slogan, New Deal. They promoted it as a New Deal in entertainment. And it gave Depression-weary audiences hope, because here's this totally unknown girl, Ruby Keeler, who becomes a star. And it said, well, if this nobody can make it big, maybe you can get out of the Depression too.
Hmm.
I got it! Well, what is it? A penny?
A nickel? Will you hold your horses and let me get the dirt off?
And following the 60s, of course, the 1970s, a time of still continuing struggle in the U.S., not a great age for the movie musical. But you single out one, Cabaret, what, 72, 74? I can't recall.
72.
Why did it work?
Well, for one thing, it paid attention to the world around it. It connected a lot of the unrest going on in the entire world by that time, from the 60s and early 70s, with the rise of Nazi Germany. And it did so in a very sort of hard-edged, unsentimental way. There weren't nuns defeating these Nazis or anything like that. It seemed relevant. But then after that, musicals just sort of faded away. You had things like MAME and Lost Horizon, which seemed totally clueless. And something like that's going to alienate a large part of the population, and that's what happened.
MAME with Lucille Ball, a hit on television. What was it the New York Times columnist Pauline Kael said about her?
Did she do her own singing, or was she dubbed by Dick Cavett?
While you can ponder that question, we'll listen to a little bit from Maybe This Time. This is Liza Minnelli's pretty transcendent performance in Cabaret.
Well,
we're talking about this submerged movie genre that keeps resurfacing, the musical. Richard Barrios is with us. He worked in the music and film industry before turning to film history, and his new book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. Makes the case that musicals are surprisingly sophisticated bellwethers of American culture, taste preference, and even politics. I want to stay on that connection to the real world and look at musicals as one of the more integrated refuges in Hollywood for African Americans, for sexuality in the days of the Hays Code, the Motion Picture Production Code, and homosexuality on film. Why, Richard Barrios, do musicals get a pass in those forbidden places?
Well, I think part of it was because entertainment actually had higher profile gay and lesbian people and African Americans participating in them. And so many of the early musicals were backstage theatrical stories. And since these personalities were part of that life, it was sort of easier to bring them along. The very first musical film, as we now consider musicals, was The Broadway Melody, which opened early in 1929, and it featured very prominently a gay costume designer. A few months after that, the early musical On With the Show, which was also a backstage story, featured the wonderful recording and stage performer Ethel Waters introducing the song Am I Blue and totally hitting it out of the ballpark.
I think
so. And this sort of continued on. It waxed and waned, but by the 1940s, you had Ethel Waters again with Lena Horne in the great musical Cabin in the Sky. You had the Nicholas Brothers and Lena Horne in Stormy Weather. And you had very covert but nevertheless detectable to people who understood gay presences in movies like Lady in the Dark and Broadway Rhythm, some of those things.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of that. This is Lena Horne singing Stormy Weather. Let's talk about the medium of film for a moment. Making things matter, as you point out, is not simply adapting a successful Broadway show for film, nor does it work the other way around. What is it specifically about the medium of film that makes it fly or not?
Well, one of the mistakes I think that a lot of live shows are making now that are adapted from movies is that they try to copy movie techniques onto the live stage. And these are two completely different mediums, and they should not be confused with one another. They should not overlap. And I wish they'd stop trying to adapt animated films into live stage shows. It doesn't really work. Lion King was good, and they should have stopped there.
Well, I was going to stop you on that because I would say Lion King did work. But the whole idea of the musical, it is pretty awkward and silly in its own way, right? I mean, I'm thinking
it can be.
Well, I'm thinking of that, you know, in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you have the Scottish father who, you know, when his son, you hear the music start to swell and his son is posing like he's about to sing and he's saying, no, stop the music. There's not going to be any singing.
Exactly. And really, song cues and that sort of thing have been a target since the very beginning of musicals and sound in the late 1920s, even. You see some early musicals make fun of some of those conventions because they are silly. And let's face it, musicals do have to occupy their own particular world with a certain kind of suspension of disbelief.
Well, why do you think we're willing to suspend disbelief for a musical?
I think the best answer to that would come in the way that a really good musical can give the effect of making dreams seem tangible. They sort of tap into our subconscious and provide these brilliant, when they're done well, illustrations of what we dream about and what we think about. And, you know, to make fantasies seem real is quite an achievement. And musicals do it in a very specific way. And it's a way that the tenor of the times isn't always connected with, which is why they go in and out of fashion so much.
Well, we just scraped the surface, Richard Barrios, but I want to thank you so much for your time.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town?
That was my earlier conversation with Richard Barrios, author of Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Still Matter. Well, today has been kind of an exploration of the arts, from Oscar predictions to movie musicals. And when we return, a conversation with fantasy novelist Victoria Schwab. It's the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, when word of mouth continues. And all their jazz.
And all that jazz. I'm Victoria Schwab, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Victoria Schwab, V.E. Schwab, the author's name depends on her audience, which, like the dark worlds that she builds, is a well-thought-out design. Ms. Schwab, we'll say, burst onto the scene in 2011 with The Near Witch. A dozen books later, adult, young adult, and middle grade readers have followed her into supernatural worlds, sinister scenarios, and richly formed fantasy metropolises. Her newest novel, A Conjuring of Light, is part three and the culmination of the Shades of Magic fantasy series. We reached Victoria Schwab at her home in Nashville via Skype. I admit I was curious about which name you would use to introduce yourself, because you are Victoria Schwab, you are V.E. Schwab. Who have we got today?
Well, I'm all the same person. Every now and then I get a reader who doesn't realize that Victoria Schwab and V.E. Schwab are the same, and it's kind of fun because they're both me. I'm Victoria Elizabeth, or V.E., and part of it is just that I like having a little bit of brand differentiation between what I write for kids and what I write for adults. I wouldn't necessarily want one of my 8 or 9-year-old readers to pick up something like Vicious, which is quite dark. The other reason, and kind of more the more frank answer, is that, you know, adult fantasy is a very male-dominant and male-centric industry. And you would be amazed how many times I get told by female readers that they're so glad they didn't know I was a woman, or else they wouldn't have picked up my book.
Really? God, how does that make you feel?
Oh, it's awful. I mean, I'm glad they pick it up. And my philosophy is always that I would rather kind of take down that patriarchy notion from the inside. So I like it when I get male readers who are surprised to find out that I'm a woman, but they figure it out after they've read and liked my books. And I'm like, now you can go and you can deal with your like kind of entrenched misogyny on your own time.
But
I would hate for someone not to pick up my book because of the name on the cover. Plus, I also just kind of feel like a VE. If I had my druthers now, if I could go back, I think I would brand everything that way. There's something a little bit more cool and chic about just the VE on the cover.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. A lot of my friends just call me V, and I think it's pretty sleek.
People call me V on the internet, but I think it's more just that they're lazy and it's 7 letters shorter than Victoria.
How about, you know, besides that strategy and the brand differentiation, how about you as a writer? Do you have to kind of put on different hats or personalities writing for those various different audiences?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people assume that my younger books are somehow lighter and my adult books are darker. It's really not the case at all. If anything, I figured out early on that the only real differentiation for me is the kind of humor. I think that dark humor is something we pick up on our way out of our teen years, not our way in. And so my adult books tend to have a thread of very kind of gallows humor to them, whereas my middle grade and YA have a bit more of an authentic voice. But really, for me, the primary differentiation between all my books is I'm simply writing to a different version of myself. Hmm. I'm writing a book to 10-year-old me or 19-year-old me or 29-year-old me. And I was weird at all of those ages. So they're always going to be strange books. But I really don't sit down with my YA novels and think any differently from my adult novels. Obviously, the stories are very different. So the hardest part for me changing gears is not thinking about the audience, but thinking about the characters and the story and the world, and just getting myself into a different headspace, a different kind of narrative, whether it's a thriller or a fantasy or just a classic action adventure. There's a lot of other factors you have to worry about without kind of getting into, and now I'm writing for teenagers, you know?
And do those various different yous at different ages, do they look like you actually did and act like you actually did, or is it sort of the more perfect version of you?
Oh, God, no. My characters are just as flawed as I was. I'm definitely one of those kids that was pretty dark and pretty morbid, and I'm writing to that self. I tend to write about strong female characters, and I tend to make them fairly self-interested because I think there's this trend in YA, and to be honest, in most fiction, where if you have a powerful female character, they also must be selfless. They have to be willing to kind of throw it away to save the world. At 16, I would have let the world burn if it meant I could be happy. You know, I just don't, subscribe to this idea that girls should have to be willing to give up their power and men should get to, like, embrace it.
Well, now, your new book, A Conjuring of Light, this is book three of the A Darker Shade of Magic series, and you've made it clear that it will be the last in this series. Do you plot series out ahead of time? You know, do you know what's going to happen and know when it's going to end?
I knew the ending for the Black Magic arc when I started Darker Shade of Magic. I didn't know exactly how many books it would take me to get to the ending. I didn't know if it would be two or three or four, but I knew what the ending was. I need to have an endpoint because if I'm having a bad day, it keeps me from quitting. And if I'm having a good day, then I look forward to getting to the end.
What do you do when you're stuck?
Resist the urge to delete everything. I usually hit a point where I'm like, let's just delete it all. And at that point, my friends are like, please step away from the computer and, like, let's go to a movie. Everything will be fine. I go work out. I get out and I actually put physical distance between me and the computer when I get stuck.
Well, you're known for writing fantasy, obviously, and YA fiction. I'm wondering, with fantasy, you know, there really aren't any rules. You can invent anything. Do you have your own limits? Do you have your own, you know, okay, that would be jumping the shark or any set of thinking like that?
I'm glad you said it because it's actually, like, one of my great pet peeves, because there is this notion that fantasy equals a carte blanche, and it's not true. You know, a good fantasy has just as many rules as good science fiction or good general fiction. You have to have rules because you can really ask your readers to suspend disbelief for one step, and anything past that, you're going to start losing them. And so my goal is to make my worlds, while they are fantasy, as realistic and as grounded as possible. And I lean into intuitive world building and systems that people could actually envision and see themselves in. I lean into accessibility because of that. Like, the last thing I want is to ask my readers to make random leaps by suddenly adding dragons to the Shades of Magic series or something. You know, like, I'm a very, very firm believer that all good fantasy follows rules.
Hmm. What's the best advice you ever got about writing?
The best advice I ever got was actually advice about publishing. And the advice was, if you're in this long enough, everything that can happen will. The good and the bad, the highs and the lows. And that's something I was told at the very, very beginning of my career, and it really has sustained me, because then when something bad does happen, and it always does happen, instead of being thrown, instead of letting that fear take over, you realize that it's a sign that you are in the game. You know, that, like, this is the price that you pay for participation. And it's just one of those checks and balances, one of those ways to gauge whether you're doing something that you love.
Victoria Schwab, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Victoria Schwab, author of Vicious, The Everyday Angel, and most recently, A Conjuring of Light. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop is produced by Sarah Plord with help from Maureen McMurray. And we thank you for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Velela Velela, Poddington Bear, and Jazar. We also want to make sure you know that Krista Tippett is going to be joining me for Writers on a New England Stage next Thursday. That's March 2nd at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. She's host of On Being, heard here on NHPR, and we're going to be talking about her newest book. It's called Becoming Wise, and it is, as she puts it, an inquiry into the art of living. She draws from her interviews with religious and spiritual leaders and scientists and poets and politicians to investigate the nature of wisdom with people who grappled with social and economic and environmental issues and inequality and the nature of faith, and their own real or imagined limitations to find a way forward. I think it's going to be a rich and timely conversation, and I hope you'll join us for a night out. There's more at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.